The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
From the Carver Center for Public Radio, this is your home for NPR programs and NPR news every day of the year, 91.3 KUAF. And also your home for Ozarks at Large. It's Thursday, February 16th, 2017. I'm Kyle Kellums. Later today, a campus carry bill continues to collect support at the state capitol. Playwright Lisa D'Amore talks about her Pulitzer Prize finalist work, Detroit, now being produced by Theater Squared. And for our Thursday archive, we hear part of an interview recorded for Ozarks at Large 20 years ago this week with comedian and activist Dick Gregory. First, Eureka Springs is a town with a rich history of hosting people seeking cures. The waters have, for more than a century, been touted by some as a way to improve health. Now, there are people in the village that want Eureka to become a 21st century mecca for medical marijuana. This, after Arkansas voters approved such legislation last November. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
The sound of historic Grotto Spring in downtown Eureka Springs. And this is Sweet Spring. Magnetic Spring is the most productive. But Basin Spring was the first discovered in the mid-1800s by pioneers who claimed the water could heal. Soon, crowds of sick and disabled came by horseback and wagon to take the water cure for fevers, pain, even cancer. Those who stayed named the place Eureka Springs and established a grand Victorian-era health spa. Nearly 140 years later, tourists still visit Eureka Springs' many spring reservations, but just maybe by this time next year, Eureka Springs Mayor Robert Butch Berry, a fourth-generation Carroll County resident, hopes medical marijuana tourists will be flocking here as well.
It's going to be a tremendous benefit to Eureka Springs and add another element of the healing properties of the community.
The Arkansas Medical Marijuana Commission and Alcoholic Beverage Control Division of the Department of Finance and Administration will regulate and have oversight of Arkansas's 32 dispensaries and 5 marijuana cultivation facilities. The state legislature also has filed more than a dozen bills to change the law. Once rules are established, the commission will begin to choose applicants who will have to pay hefty licensing fees, bonds, and prove cash assets. Implementation is scheduled for May 8th. Sandy Martin is chair of Eureka Springs Mayor's Task Force on Economic Development.
The tourism industry is a wonderful industry, but as we all know, it's traditionally one of the lowest paying jobs, and it's seasonal, and there's a high amount of turnover.
Low wage waitresses, motel and hotel maids, shop clerks, and cooks tend to come and go, she says.
What we need is new industry, and we think that the medical marijuana end of it, feeding into kind of rebranding Eureka Springs as a medical arts center, would be a great shot in the arm for our economy.
The Arkansas Department of Health will issue medical marijuana patient registry identification cards. Individuals deemed by their physician to have any of 18 qualifying conditions ranging from Alzheimer's, cancer, arthritis, hepatitis C, and nausea. A medical marijuana industry, Sandy Martin says, would complement the dozens of massage therapists, acupuncturists, and herbalists that operate around Eureka Springs.
We're a town of a little under 2,100 people, but we have to have public services and infrastructure to accommodate over 1.5 million people a year. That means we have major police force, first responders. We have phenomenal medical professionals here, hospitals. We can probably provide better oversight per capita.
Martin, a public relations specialist, worked early on with David Couch, the Little Rock lawyer who sponsored the medical marijuana constitutional amendment in Arkansas. She invited Couch to Eureka in late December to talk about how the new law might work, and he plans to return once all the rules are in place. We contacted a half dozen residents interested in opening a grow operation or dispensary, all declined to talk on record for now. But Eureka Springs Mayor Butch Berry says he knows of four groups of investors who plan to apply for a permit. And Sandy Martin says with medical marijuana city tax collections, Eureka could also invest in medical marijuana research.
A science research center on medical marijuana, cultivation, research lab, incubator, anything like that. We could do that.
Still, for now, the efficacy of medical marijuana remains hazy, much like the alleged healing properties of Eureka's historic cold water springs. I'm Jacqueline Froelich, reporting for Ozarks at Large.
A bill requiring public colleges and universities to allow staff to carry concealed handguns on campus easily advanced out of the Arkansas Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday. Sponsored by Fayetteville Republican Representative Charlie Collins, the bill now heads to the full Senate after passing the House earlier this month. In committee, several spoke for and against the bill. Northwest Arkansas Technical Institute President Blake Robertson says the proposal allows his institution to fill in the security gaps because of a lack of funding.
We have a wonderful partnership with the Springdale Police Department. We have 2 hours of protection during the morning, and then we have 2 hours of protection during the evening. Not complaining, but that's all we can afford. We are a soft target.
Most public institutions, including the University of Arkansas and Arkansas State University Systems, are opposing the bill. The legislation would not allow students to possess concealed firearms, and it does exempt campuses within a half mile of hospitals and presidential libraries. Representative Collins says existing bans on concealed firearms at stadiums, churches, and bars would also still apply. Eve Jorgensen of the group Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense spoke against the bill.
This bill assumes that ordinary citizens with no law enforcement training would be able to stop a shooter without unintentionally injuring innocent bystanders. We don't believe that untrained college professors should or are able to take on the role of law enforcement.
Representative Collins says allowing concealed carry on campuses would add an extra measure of defense in the event of a mass shooting. The chairman of the Judiciary Senate Committee, Jeremy Hutchinson, tried but failed to apply an amendment to the bill requiring campus concealed carry holders to undergo at least 16 hours of active shooter training. Arkansas State University System President Chuck Welsh also spoke against the bill, arguing campuses should maintain the ability to decide for themselves whether or not to allow guns.
Our Board of Trustees has made the decision to opt out. Now, this has not been something that just those five individuals decided. That was based upon feedback that we received from the campus constituencies on all of our campuses.
Senate sponsor Republican Trent Garner argues that the ultimate form of local control rests not with a university board or governing body, but with an individual.
You deal with a fundamental civil right. The choice should not be on this body. It should not be on a university president. It shouldn't be on a local government. The greatest form of choice should go to that individual.
This is Ozarks at Large.
This week on All Things Considered, scientists might be allowed to do something geneticists have previously feared.
It was never seriously considered permissible, but of course we never really had to face that choice until now.
How editing genes in human gametes and embryos could prevent disease, plus what changing NAFTA could mean for farmers and consumers. Listen to All Things Considered every day.
This afternoon from 3 to 6 on 91.3. And ahead this hour, Northwest Arkansas has the Roots Festival every August. And across the state, there is the Johnny Cash Music Festival, guided by Roseanne Cash, Johnny's daughter.
He didn't see an interview with my dad that he didn't mention how formative growing up here was for him and how his music was seeded from this very soil and the hard work and the family. And he took such great pride in it. He did not romanticize picking cotton for 1 second.
Details on the concert with Roseanne Cash, Chris Christopherson, and others in Northeast Arkansas this fall. That's ahead on today's Ozarks at Large.
Thousands of listeners to KUAF give annual or monthly gifts online at supportkuaf.com.
The Little Rock Convention and Visitors Bureau is concerned a proposed bathroom bill in the Arkansas legislature targeting transgender people could have a detrimental impact on the state. President and CEO Gretchen Hall says North Carolina has suffered major economic losses from having conferences and sports tournaments canceled and companies abandoning plans to relocate or expand operations. Hall says Arkansas would be especially susceptible.
It is definitely worth noting that tourism is Arkansas's second largest economic industry, a total impact of $7.2 billion per year. And I think, you know, people really need to take a hard look at the economic trickle effect that a bill like this could potentially have that would really damage that impact to our state economy.
The measure doesn't yet offer any specifics, but Republican Senator Gary Stubblefield says it would require people to use public bathrooms that correspond to the sex on their birth certificate. Hall says a similar law in North Carolina led to the NCAA to cancel tournaments, while Texas is studying a similar proposal.
Their research shows that Texas could be looking at an $8.5 billion economic loss, and according to the Texas Association of Business, up to 185,000 jobs. Those are huge impacts. And here locally, you know, NCAA alone, Little Rock and North Little Rock hosted two very prestigious NCAA events in recent years.
The measure is eventually expected to be taken up by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Stubblefield did not respond to requests for comment. This is a Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large, and on Thursdays, we catch up on business in the region and state with the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Hi, I'm Paul Gatling, editor of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. Today, we'll visit with Charles Charlow, retired Fayetteville business executive who was recently inducted into the state's Business Hall of Fame. We'll look at some of the historical numbers associated with the Hall of Fame, and Business Journal reporter Jeff De La Rosa will also join me to discuss how close we might be to seeing self-driving trucks hauling freight on Arkansas interstates. Let's begin with Charles Charlow. If there was a Mount Rushmore of Fayetteville business leaders, his name might be in the running. After serving in World War II, Charlow earned a law degree from the UA in 1951 and went to work for Arkansas Western Gas. The company changed its name to Southwestern Energy Company in 1979, and that same year, Charlow was appointed president and CEO, where he served until retiring in 1999. He held a variety of leadership roles throughout the state and was a member of the UA Board of Trustees for a decade. In a telephone interview with me, Charlow spoke about the Hall of Fame recognition, a lifetime of public service, and the evolution of Northwest Arkansas the past 60 plus years. Charles, now that you have been formally recognized as one of the all-time successful and accomplished business leaders in the history of Arkansas, just describe that feeling for me. How did that set in for you during the banquet in Little Rock?
Well, it's almost overwhelming. You look at the accomplishments and the people who have already been inducted and the other ones that came in the same time I did, it's quite humbling to be among them. I mean, but you just are so grateful that you've been able to do a few things and get recognized. There's some real giants in there, and I don't think I really fit in in the giant category, but it's just a real privilege to be recognized like they did.
Take me back to the 1950s. You just graduated from the U of A with a law degree. You're a young attorney in 1951. What were your personal ambitions when you went to work for Arkansas Western Gas?
Well, when I first went to work for them, I recognized that they were a pretty small company in comparison to most utility companies and exploration production companies. And I really didn't know, I didn't know much about the business at all. And so I just badly needed a job. I didn't have enough money buy a bus fare out to get out of town. And my thought was I'd work for a few years with this company and then go on to and search out something bigger and better.
You've been based in Fayetteville this your entire career. You've had a front row seat to the explosive growth of Northwest Arkansas that we've all seen. Can you describe what you've seen here in the last 50, 60 years and just how overwhelming the growth has been?
Well, the growth has been overwhelming. Of course, we have to give credit to basically three companies who have generated that growth. And that, would, of course, would be Walmart and J.B. Hunt and Tyson's. I knew all of them, and they were just aggressive. I've always kind of thought that Northwest Arkansas grew because, unlike maybe some other parts of Arkansas, we didn't have good farmland or timber. And we had these rocky hills, so it took the skill and imagination of people to really build things up here. And we were fortunate in having it in the Waltons and Don Tyson and J.B. Hunt. And as our population grew, two things happened, I think, that really helped the area. One is a shift to political power, because we started having more representatives in the legislature. And the internal growth, once you get to a certain size, it seems like it feeds upon itself. There's more new businesses, new restaurants, new cleaners, or new car dealerships, and that sort of thing that come along, and it just keeps building on itself. It's growing. I think it will continue.
That's newly minted Business Hall of Famer Charles Charlo. You can read more about his career and the other members of the 2017 Hall of Fame class and the story at our website at nwabusinessjournal.com.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. That's because First Security is 100% focused on serving customers all across the state and nowhere else. It's local banking with local commitment. First Security. Bank better. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. And OneCom. OneCom provides communications options to help your business adapt to today's demands with tomorrow's technology. With opportunities in virtualization, redundancy, or maximizing your efficiency. Learn more at onecom.com. That's 1-COMM.com.
Jeff Delarosa covers the trucking and transportation beat for the Business Journal, and he's written about a couple of interesting topics lately, including self-driving semi-trailers. Jeff, how are you?
I'm fine.
Autonomous vehicles, self-driving trucks, all that technology is becoming a more widely discussed topic among transportation leaders. But are we going to be seeing self-driving semi-trailers on Arkansas interstates anytime soon?
No, the infrastructure isn't in place, but the Arkansas Trucking Association wants to change the law to allow an exception for minimum following distances. They're hoping to test platooning. It's a highly advanced form of cruise control. It allows two trucks to communicate with each other and allows them also to travel much closer together. The goal is to improve fuel efficiency and safety. The Trucking Association hopes to have this law changed by the end of this year.
And you also reported recently on a few expansion projects involving transportation companies in the area. Give us an update on how that construction's coming along.
J.B. Hunt and ArcBest are both expanding. J.B. Hunt is expanding its corporate office building in Lowell. ArcBest is expanding its corporate office in Fort Smith. It's building a 205,000 square foot corporate office building. J.B. Hunt is adding on to its existing corporate office building with a 133,000 square foot addition at its Lowell corporate office along Interstate 49. Both of these projects are expected to be completed this spring.
And finally, appropriately enough, we come to the final mile, which is a logistics term for the last leg of delivery to the consumer in the supply chain. What are carriers doing to improve their final mile delivery service?
Well, UPS and University of Arkansas have partnered to start autonomous robot delivery. This is expected to start next month on campus. J.B. Hunt is wanting to expand its service to medium and large retailers. And ArcBest wants to continue to grow its service as more products are purchased on the internet.
That's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal reporter Jeff De La Rosa, and that's the last word for this edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. You can keep up with our daily coverage of regional news at nwabusinessjournal.com. I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. The play Detroit was a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and it's on stage this month in Fayetteville, the latest production from Theater Squared. It offers us a look at neighbors in a suburb, though not necessarily near Detroit, and their respective dreams, fears, and truths for an early 21st century life. Last week, the playwright, Lisa D. Moore, was in Northwest Arkansas to see the production, to talk to some students, and to direct a playwriting workshop. A week ago tonight, she sat down with longtime friend Robert Ford, the artistic director of T2 and an accomplished playwright himself, at the Fayetteville Public Library for a discussion about Detroit and about playwriting. I asked Lisa, a New Orleans resident, about the idea that Detroit, despite the name, feels as if it could be taking place anywhere or everywhere.
It's interesting. Everywhere, that's maybe as complicated a word as universal. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, it's interesting. The play is called Detroit. And the first thing I say on the first page of the play is, it's not necessarily set in Detroit. And when I was writing the play, I really thought of, I thought of it more as a fable. And I didn't necessarily see the setting quite as naturalistically as it's been performed since I wrote it, actually. And there's a feeling, really, the way that I've seen Detroit produced the most is that the two couples, which live next door to each other, they're almost always cast as both as white couples when I've seen it. And there's a feeling of them almost being in this kind of weird suburban island, almost like they're afraid to get off of their island a little bit. It's very claustrophobic. And I do think that there's a, while I think the play is very relatable in terms of a, you know, what people are living through in their lives, there's a slightly surreal quality to it. I think some people may view it as a play that explores a lot of existential anxieties about identity and maybe some very surface ways that people, and you might even be able to argue white people, have been taught about what an American identity is. And it's almost like you're meeting some characters who maybe for the first time in their adult lives are starting to peek behind the curtain or peek behind the surface, and it makes them very anxious.
So. We should say there are two couples. They are next door neighbors. One couple has just recently moved in.
Yes.
And this is, we open with the welcoming one more established couple in the neighborhood welcoming the other one to a barbecue.
Yes.
Which is a
pretty
right,
normal.
An all-American.
What could go wrong?
Right. We're lucky. Things do. You mentioned identity. There is some sort of peeling back on what does it mean to be a, and you can fill in the blank, an American, a worker, a middle-class worker.
A success.
Right.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. And I mean, you know, I was writing this, it's interesting. I think this play is resonating really differently this year than it did in when it was first premiered actually at the very end of 2010. And I wrote it in 2009, kind of as we were recovering from that housing crisis, lots of economic anxiety going on. And I was thinking about it, you know, sort of housing burst. And I grew up kind of knowing or being taught, like, what is the way that you can have security? Own your own home, own your own home, own your own home. And there was something that happened, you know, in 2008 and 9 when suddenly, like, all of these people that thought they had security had no security. The rug had been pulled out from under them because of these loans that had been made that made it impossible for them to keep their own homes. And so I think, I was writing it at a time where, you know, the rules that people like me had been taught to play by didn't make any sense anymore. And so I think there's a sense of, there's a little bit of a sense of an underlying panic underneath all of these characters. One couple who looks sort of stable from a traditional point of view, we find out maybe they aren't quite so stable. And another that isn't financially secure at all, but is almost trying to fake it till they make it. We sort of watch them stumbling and trying to figure it all out together during the course of the play.
So you started writing this in 2009, mm-hmm. coming out of the Great Recession. Certainly a lot of anxiety. Premieres in 2010, mm-hmm. then through 11, 12. Now you're in an election cycle.
Yes.
Anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say there's some anxiety right now in 2017. There's some agreement. So even though it seems on one hand that 2009 was a couple of societal lifetimes ago,
mm-hmm.
a play about trying to figure out who we are and having some anxiety about who we are seems to be bullseye.
I know. It's going to be really interesting to see it tomorrow night. And the director wrote me an email, Aimé, while she was working on it, where she was like, we're so happy to kind of have this play, which, you know, the play, you know, we see these characters trying, and then it kind of goes to an almost desperate Bacchanal place. It's not giving away too much, yeah. you know, but she's, Aimé was like, we're so happy to have this play to kind of cling to and like almost use to kind of like work out or dance out our anxieties of this time. So I'm as startled as anybody that the play still feels relevant. but we'll see what it's like tomorrow night when I see it.
Did you write, were you in New Orleans when you were writing this?
I actually wrote it, I was in New York when I wrote
okay.
it. Yeah, but I was still very connected to New Orleans. And, you know, I was, let's see, that was 4 years after Katrina.
I was going to ask
yeah.
because...
You know, it was... Katrina was like at the edges of my imagination when I was writing this. And, you know, without kind of giving too much away about the play, you know, I was not living in New Orleans when Katrina hit, but my entire immediate family was. And my brother's house was completely flooded and then gutted and rebuilt. And, you know, so many of my friends and family's members were affected in many different ways. But no one that I knew, everyone was able to come back. So we were of a particular demographic where we actually had the means to come back, whether that meant we had insurance or a job. And I was really able, to see totally chaotic kind of federal and state level and even city level response. You know, like there, no one was prepared for it. And I was also able to see the incredible grassroots resolve to rebuild that city. And to watch something that that first year you were just like, this is never gonna work. It's gone, you know, like our culture is gone, this way of life is gone. And to watch that city rejuvenate has been, you know, a life-changing experience and a defining moment of my life. And there is a feeling in Detroit of like, how do we reimagine this? You know, do we reimagine our lives and our country from the ground up? Do we have to wipe it all out and then reimagine it? So it was somehow those questions were fueling the work.
I want to ask you both, since you're both playwrights, a little bit about the process of completion and or surrender. Mm. It plays in a book. It can be, the rights can be purchased by companies. And, you know, what's that like to say, I've done what I can do, and now somebody else somewhere, maybe tomorrow, maybe 10 years, is, oh, well, let's set this in outer space or something like that. I mean, that's a... a crazy example, but you do surrender this work and this toil out to be interpreted. Is that obviously it's okay, but is that ever frightening?
Do you want to start?
It is frightening because as Lisa pointed out earlier, the script itself is, maybe as time goes by, I feel like the importance of the actual script is sort of shrinking, and what's really important is what the actors do, what goes on between them and subtextually and the behavioral work that that's what really brings the play to life, and you can't, write that in the script. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you try everything you can to kind of indicate this is where a pretty good actor and director team would interpret it this way. But then, even then, they still need to actually be able to do it. So yeah, it's really fraught. The flip side of that is, we love theater people. We love actors as a class, and really trust them. And most of the time, you're just excited to see, wow, that's coming to life in a way that I didn't imagine, and it's coming, and then just as often it's coming to life just how I always hoped it would. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, it's fraught. It's a blueprint you're sending out, and they're building the building over and over again, and you hope that you made the plans, good.
Like, and it's weird because you have to make the plans so that they can be improvised within, which is different than like a plan, like an architect's plan for a house, which you don't really want a lot of improvising. But, it's gotten, first of all, surrendering has gotten easier for me the longer that I've been writing. With this play, it's the longer that it's in rotation, the easier it is for me to kind of watch it. I don't have kids, but I wonder if it's like, they talk about the difference between a mom with their first kid and then a mom with their like third kid. Like the first one is like everything's like, right. Oh my God. But the third kid, they're a lot more relaxed. Yes. So now I actually really enjoy, I've had some great experiences, like one where I'm very specific about the sound design of Detroit in between scenes, and I like talk about how you hear the ambient sounds of the neighborhood, and I even write down what sounds you hear. And I went to see a production in Minneapolis, and right after the first scene, like the lights went down and pop music came up, like in the darkness. And I was like, I was like, this is never gonna work. Like, this is never gonna work. This is never gonna work. And then I was like, hey, Lisa, relax. Not only did it work like great, it was just like a different dancey song mm-hmm. between each scene. Not only did it work great, like it worked fab. It was a great production. And then what I found out later when I talked to the director, I was like, oh yeah, I was really nervous, but the sound design worked great. And he was like, oh, we used music on purpose because we wanted to go to total blackout between each scene. And there's all these big set changes that have to happen. And so what we did is we didn't want any ambient light. So we the people who changed the scenery, they choreographed their moves to the songs. Mm. So they danced the set changes. So they knew like two steps to the right, da 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 da. So it allowed them to have total blackout. And I was like, that is amazing. And like, can you imagine if I had been there and been like, no, you can't use songs, like you can't do it. Like it would have really messed them up. So the more productions I see that work outside of what I basically told them to do, it's great for me.
Lisa D'Amore is the author of several works, including the Pulitzer Prize finalist, Detroit, now on stage from Theater Squared at Nadine Baum Studios in Fayetteville. We also heard from Bob Ford, the artistic director at T2, and himself a playwright. Our conversation was recorded in front of an audience in the Walker Community Room at the Fayetteville Public Library. The run for Detroit continues tonight and will last through Sunday, February 26th. Oh, and put this down on your calendar. On Tuesday, March 28th, I'll be back at the Fayetteville Public Library to talk with Shauna Gold, director of the next T2 production, Intimate Apparel. That conversation, free and open to the public, Tuesday night, March 28th, beginning at 6:30 at the Fayetteville Public Library. This is Ozarks at Large.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. My name is Pete Hartman. We're in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio this morning with Heather Pratt. She's with Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Fayetteville and has been working with the group Compassion Fayetteville on some events taking place this month, which is Black History Month. Heather, thanks for coming back up.
Thanks for having me back.
Let's remind listeners, we spoke a week and a half ago or so about the Allies for Equality event, which took place at the Fayetteville Public Library.
That's right.
We're talking about the second, I guess, in that series of events. We're having another Allies for Equality, and that's going to be this evening, correct?
That's right. This evening from 5:30 to 8 at Good Shepherd, we're going to be hosting the same workshop again for anyone who was unable to attend it the first time. And, you know, we had a really great turnout the first time. We had a lot of great discussions taking place. It was really wonderful to see. So I'm really looking forward to hosting this event again and reaching that many more people.
What's the focus of this workshop?
Well, the focus is really to prepare allies to come alongside their Black brothers and sisters. First of all, to challenge any potential lingering racism or biases that we have within ourselves, maybe to recognize it within our larger culture, and then to prepare us to have conversations about this with people who don't yet see racism as still an issue affecting people today.
How many folks do you think you had at the first one?
Well, you know, we had a little bit over 50 people there, which was great. And so this time, just based on how many people have responded through Facebook, I think we're going to have a little bit more than that. And I love that, because the idea is, after they've completed the workshop, you know, each of us has our own circle of influence, you know, the various people we interact with on a day-to-day basis, so that we can be maybe challenging some of those things that we're hearing people say, but doing that in an empathetic way where they're more likely to listen to what we have to say. My hope is that after people attend this workshop, it opens their eyes a little bit so that they keep learning themselves, but that it also prepares them to maybe have some of those discussions, whether online or in person, about racism.
Heather Pratt works with Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Fayetteville, has also been donating her time with the group Compassion Fayetteville for some events taking place this month, which is Black History Month. Heather, good seeing you again. Hope to see some more people out there tonight.
Great. Thanks so much.
For more on tonight's community discussion and workshop, you can go online to compassionfayetteville.wordpress.com. This is KUAF, where local matters.
The 2017 Cow Patty Run is Friday, March 17th at 5:45 p.m. at Gully Park in Fayetteville. This 5K and 1K fun run, hosted by the Spark Foundation, supports educational projects through the Fayetteville Public Education Foundation, as well as the Foundation's youth and community programming. Race registration and information available at cowpaddyrun.com. The Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra welcomes violinist Philip Pagodi as he performs Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto February 18th at the Arend Art Center in Bentonville. The winner of the APO University of Arkansas Concerto Aria Competition will also perform. Tickets and information at arkansasphilharmonic.org. 91.3 FM KUAF is supported by Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include radiation, CLIA-certified labs, a multidisciplinary lung clinic, and a lung cancer screening program. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com. And it's time to announce a winner for this weekend's Great Food in Bowls double feature. The second annual Fayetteville Gumbo Cook-Off is Saturday from noon to 6 at the Washington County Fairgrounds, raising money for the Juvenile Diabetes Fund. And then the 16th annual Soup Sunday from Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families is Sunday afternoon at the John Q. Hammond Center in Rogers. We're giving away to one lucky winner tickets to both. And our winner is Nancy Barnes. Nancy also played along and in her email offered her favorite food best served in a bowl. Actually, she listed more than one. She had gazpacho, fish stew, turkey chili, and vichyssoise. I bet Nancy has many bowls in her house. Other listener favorites that were offered up: gumbo, gumbo with rice, red beans and rice, an Appalachian stew called burgoo. We need more information about that. Lucky Charms and ice cream.
Thanks, everyone, for entering. Nancy will be in touch to get you your tickets. An annual music festival to celebrate the music of the Man in Black is literally being moved to the Johnny Cash Boyhood Home, or that is, next to the home. Jonathan Reeves with our partner station KASU gives us the details.
In 2011, Arkansas State University started the process of acquiring and restoring the Johnny Cash Boyhood Home in Dyess. In order to raise funds for the project, the Johnny Cash Music Festival was held in Jonesboro. Over the years, the Boyhood Home, the old theater building, and the administration building have been restored under the first phase of the project, thanks to the proceeds from the music festival. In order to start the second phase of work, the Johnny Cash Heritage Festival will take place. Instead of one concert being held in Jonesboro, this festival will cover 3 days in October. A symposium will take place October 19th and 20th, and the music portion of the festival will be held Saturday, October 21st in Dyess. Johnny Cash's oldest daughter, Roseanne, says it's appropriate that the festival and music be held at the location where the Cash family moved during the New Deal era. Roseanne says the cotton fields that surround the home are perfect for the concert because the land was an inspiration for much of her dad's music.
He didn't see an interview with my dad that he didn't mention how formative growing up here was for him and how his music was seeded from this very soil and the hard work and the family. And he took such great pride in it. He did not romanticize picking cotton for one second, but he knew the value of learning a work ethic that was founded in the hard work that they did, and he took that work ethic with him his whole life.
The Dyess Colony was created in 1934 as part of President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal to aid the nation's recovery from the Great Depression. Cash explains how it impacted the families who lived there.
It's such an important part of American history. People don't think about the New Deal and the Works Progress Administration and what that meant to Americans when it happened. I guess maybe it's too close and not close enough for us to really take in the gravity of what that meant for Americans. And 500 desperately poor families moved to Dyess, Arkansas because FDR created a WPA community here, and it saved them. And the Cash family moved here in 1935, and they were saved by that program.
Roseanne Cash. The music on October 21st will feature Osceola native Buddy Jewell at 12:15. At 1:30, Tommy and Joanne Cash will perform. At 3 o'clock, Roseanne Cash and Chris Christopherson will perform a two-hour concert. A hydraulic stage for the concert will be placed in a field next to the Boyhood Home, and proceeds from this festival will be used to start the second phase of the project, which will be to recreate the farmstead buildings at the Cash Boyhood Home project. Reporting from Jonesboro, I'm Jonathan Reeves.
That's trumpeter Freddie Hubbard with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. Hello, I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday night from 10 till midnight on 91.3 and on KUAF HD3 from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Saturday mornings. Join me for more Art Blakey, plus music from Ray Drummond, Bobby Watson, and much more. That's Shades of Jazz here on KUAF.
This is Ozarks at Large. Today, like many of our Thursdays, we have a memory, and we're going back exactly 20 years ago this week. Our February 14th, 1997 show had an interview with comedian and activist Dick Gregory. He was on the University of Arkansas campus that week to deliver an address sponsored by the organization Black Students Association. After his speech, he sat down with Sherita Patterson, who only had to ask a brief question to get Dick Gregory talking.
What inspired you to give the speech that you did tonight?
Well, I've always believed that money is not power, and education is not power, but information is power. And I think the problem with America, I guess I believe in a moral dictator, because if I took over the country, your station would be mandatory. I mean, you wouldn't go to bed at night until you tell me you listen to public radio. I mean, I spend about $250 every week on newspapers and magazines. And I've learned a long time ago that money is not power, that education, that information is power. And, you know, to get up in the morning and turn on, you know, the public information radio and listen to the station all day long, just listen to the information, that's what makes a society free. is when you have information, not a society that's manipulated and told this and that. And so consequently, I walk up here knowing that truth don't have to be validated by ignorance, and not up here to sit a popularity contest or a beauty contest. When I go to bed at night, I look to my God, and I have this little counter that people use to count in concerts, and it clicks. And I click every time I say thank and praise God every day. And so when I go to bed at night, I look and see what the number is and show it to God. I say, remember me now, you know. And so I just feel that you and I, what I try to say tonight, the one thing we all have in common that supersedes our blackness, our whiteness, our Jewishness, our Italianness, our African Americanness, our Asian, our femaleness, our richness, our poor, is God is responsible for one thing. It made us all human. Nothing else. Now, when we get past that, we get into isms and osms and culture patterns. And the one God forced to me put us all here with a light. I don't care how handicapped, how poor, how white, how black, how middle, we all have this lantern that's lighted. And only you, your family, and the people around you that controls your environment can blow that out. And once that's blown out, you come out of the graces of God. Racism, sexism blows it out. And it makes no difference if you know it or not. I mean, if a child 2 months old is in a house and it's cold in the wintertime and somebody go down the basement and cut the heat off, that baby gonna freeze to death. And so you are responsible for your environment. Your environment's responsible for you. And so consequently, it is this civil rights movement, this human rights movement that caught me when my light was almost out. My light was dim. And now they have my light glowing. And this is what I try to say to the audience across this country. It's not about you liking me. I mean, I hear the O.J. Simpson trial and everybody talking about, you know, racial harmony. That's crap. You know, Liz Taylor will probably live because she was examined and they found she had a brain tumor. But remember now, she got examined because she was feeling bad. And she was honest enough to admit that maybe there's something wrong. America. The O.J. trial was no more than Liz Taylor finding out she got a tumor. And the O.J. trial is we found out that we had another examination and we still sick. This haven't changed. I mean, we lie. We as black folks sit and try to smooth it over because we don't want to go out here and go through what it takes to clean this thing up. You see, I pride myself as being an agitator. And I tell people, if you don't know what an agitator is, the next time you put some clothes, your old dirty drawers in the washing machine, look at that thing called the agitator and take it out. And when you come back, all you're going to have is some wet, dirty drawers. And I don't have to worry about being validated by the bank, by the president, by powerful people, by Queen Elizabeth. There's a universal God force. The same God force that made Queen Elizabeth is responsible for making that wino. And when both of them pray, the wino's prayers and Queen Elizabeth's prayers get to God at the same time, because God have no wino's, have no queens. It's how bright is your light. That's why you get into this club. And we can sit around. And, you know, and I try to tell people that one day if you look at America the same way you look at your body, that just because my toe is down there on the ground, it's part of the total picture. And because my head is at the top, it's still part of my toe. And if I shoot myself in the toe, my whole body is going to be affected. Well, if you ever just sit one day and look at America with all of its people, if you could draw a whole big, huge picture and show America as a body and all the races and all the sexes and all the religions in this body, and if your foot was stupid enough to cuss your heart or try to hurt it, it's affecting the whole body. And so when we as a family look down and say to the foot, I'm going to shoot you because you down there with all the dirt. You're affecting nobody. That's the way racism and sexism works in this country. And somewhere we got to turn it around. And once we turn it around, we see a difference.
That was Dick Gregory, the comedian, actor, and activist, talking with our reporter, Sherita Patterson, in February 2017. Gregory is still active, and over the past couple of decades, he's become quite a proponent of healthy diet and lifestyle. He'll turn 85 later this year. Sherita Patterson Rodriguez still lives in Northwest Arkansas, and she's quite busy as well. She's a technologist for Walmart Corporate and president of Sunshine School and Development Center Board of Directors. And on that same program 20 years ago this week, we also had an interview with a then freshman congressman from Arkansas. Asa Hutchinson was in his second month in the U.S. House, and he had just voted against a proposed constitutional amendment that would have imposed term limits on U.S. senators and representatives, even though he was a strong supporter of term limits. The amendment he voted against would have placed 12-year caps on both sides of the Capitol. But Arkansas voters had approved a measure that demanded any Arkansas representative not support any proposed constitutional amendment that didn't cap House tenures at 6 years.
And because of the very specific language in Arkansas, I proposed my own amendment to comply with the instruction of the Arkansas voters, which failed. It gained about 80 votes, but it also caused me to vote against the term limits proposal that had the best chance of passing, which was 12 years. For those people who have fought hard and long for term limits, I know this is disappointing to them, and I was disappointed because it was my intention to vote for all the term limit proposals that would be presented.
That was then-Congressman, now Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, talking to Ozarks at Large 20 years ago this week. Most Thursdays, we grab archive material from the past 27 years to hear once again.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Mahershala Ali, who's nominated for an Oscar as Best Supporting Actor for his performance in Moonlight as a drug dealer who becomes the father figure to a young boy. Moonlight is nominated for Best Picture, and so is another film Ali co-stars in, Hidden Figures. He gave a very moving speech when accepting a SAG Award last month for his performance in Moonlight. Join us.
Fresh Air tomorrow at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF. Feed Communities invites backyard gardeners and farmers to participate in Plant a Row. One in four children living in Northwest Arkansas is hungry. Plant a Row puts your extra produce to good use by donating it directly to local food pantries, serving these hungry families in our communities. Feedcommunities.org to take the Plant a Row pledge or to learn more. SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, presents its Masterworks 2 concert March 4th at Walton Arts Center. It will feature Beethoven's iconic Fifth Symphony, Arvo Pärt's Fratra for strings and percussion, and guest violinist Alexei Kenny performing Sibelius' Concerto for violin. Tickets available at 443-5600 or sonamusic.org. And support for 91.3 comes from Malco Theaters, featuring the Metropolitan Opera February 25th with a live performance of Dvorak's Rusalka. This Czech opera comes to life in HD and on the big screen at 11:55 a.m. as Rusalka, a water nymph, begins her journey to become human. Fandango.com for tickets and information. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Green Forest. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Callens. We'll end with music from Adam Fawcett. This is his song, Dust. You can catch him Friday night at Smoke and Barrel in Fayetteville. I'm Kyle Callens. Thanks for listening.
The dust clouds in space, they sing, come join us.